Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. So today we thought we'd had a conversation of a topic that we encounter a lot in our work, actually, and as we look into the different ways in which changes in the climate drive or influence conflict, and that is maladaptation to climate change.
And if you've never heard of the term and are wondering if maladaptation is just the opposite of adaptation to climate change, it depends on how you look at it. As with a lot of terminology, there's important nuance. And in this episode, we hope to clarify the concept, share some examples of how it plays out, and hopefully support our listeners in considering maladaptation and ways to avoid and mitigate it in your work.
So if you haven't understood yet what climate change has to do with security, if you got lost at some point in that train, if you lost the station, or if you have, but you do want to know what you can do about it from your position as a policymaker, as a researcher, or a practitioner in the areas of climate, environment, development, or peace building, if you're just looking for that thread, right? Okay, I know the problem, but how does it fit into my work? Then maybe this episode is for you. Because we're going to look a lot into these connections and into the background of how these connections play out. But before we just dive into the topic of today, maladaptation, let's just have a quick overview of what actually adaptation is, adaptation to climate change.
Yeah, I think it's perfect to start here. So I know we're here to have a conversation about adaptation and even more specifically maladaptation, but I do think it's really helpful to mention what mitigation is and how the two are different. Especially in the climate field, you hear mitigation a lot. And what it refers to is making the impacts of climate change less severe by preventing or reducing emissions of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. For example, this is where measures like increasing the share of renewable energy comes in, or increasing the size of forests that can act as carbon sinks. And these interventions prevent emissions from occurring in the first place. And adaptation is probably best understood as the process of adjusting to current and future effects of climate change. So while it's forward-looking, it's still about preventing or often minimizing the damage that is caused by climate impacts that result from emissions. Some good examples include large-scale infrastructure changes like building defenses to protect against sea level rise and nature-based solutions like protecting forests and mangroves. And I know I'm getting a little bit in depth in our opening or framing of the conversation, but I don't think we can talk about adaptation without mentioning the justice component of it, and I want to do so right up front. As we're seeing an unquestionable need for increased funding and investments for both adaptation and loss and damage in fragile and conflict-affected areas, these areas are often the most impacted by climate change, but have contributed to emissions the least. So it's really important that wealthy countries with high historical emissions help bridge this gap in adaptation financing.
Good work already setting the tone there for us to weave in the matter of justice from the start. That's a great point, and I hope we keep up with it throughout this episode because it's very relevant. Also, good idea to distinguish between the terms because they are used interchangeably.
Constantly.
Or just together.
Mitigation and adaptation. Yeah. It's all one word. It's not three.
Yeah. But they're actually quite different. You're right. You're mitigating, you're trying to stop it, and you're adapting. It's like, okay, we couldn't stop it, or we couldn't stop these impacts from arising from it. I mean, we know that we
exactly.
are at that point where we can't just mitigate anymore. Things are already in process. You also have to adapt. You have to do both, but they are different. Yeah. Thank you for that. That was a great background. And knowing that, knowing what climate adaptation is all about and how it's different from mitigation, we can now dive into what happens when we don't adapt. And actually, I always argue that there is no such thing because humans always look for ways to adapt to their adverse conditions. And we wouldn't be here if this wouldn't be part of the human experience. I'm pretty sure our ancestors had to deal with all kinds of adverse conditions, and we are here today because they did. So yes, it is an intrinsic part of the human experience. But the problem that we deal with, first of all, we're having these rapid changes, so they require much more rapid and extreme adaptation measures. And the second thing is that if you don't support people, if you don't give them support, if you don't offer safety networks for when catastrophe hits to deal with these changes, then they will adapt with whatever they have available. And oftentimes the people who are affected first and have to adapt fast are the ones who don't have all these many types of resources available for them. So often their act of adapting to the changes in their environment, which obviously affect their livelihoods directly, can themselves become part of a bigger problem. And what I mean with this is that their adaptation can exacerbate climate and environmental change inadvertently. And it can also cause or even exacerbate insecurity dynamics on the other side. And to look into this complex relationship, a few examples, they always help. Of course, we think immediately of farmers because it's one of the first groups to feel these impacts of a changing climate and a changing environment. They will often have to adapt very quickly in order to survive. And we've seen it in a few of our studies that in Afghanistan, we had these farmers who were struggling to make ends meet amidst these frequent droughts that were affecting their food production, actually turning away towards poppy production because it's a drought-resistant crop. It's water-saving crop, so it works very well in these drought conditions, but it's used for opium production, so moving away from food to producing opium. We also saw something very similar in Colombia with poor peasant farmers turning to illegal coca, marijuana production because their other livelihood options were just deteriorating. So on the one hand, for the families themselves, for these farmers, this has allowed them to guarantee their own survival, the survival of their families. So it's a valid point from their perspective. But their activities are now strengthening criminal networks and contributing also to the expansion of armed groups, which most of the time control these businesses and even finance their own activity through these businesses. And then insecurity just starts unfolding in these contexts. And especially for the involved farmers themselves. So it's a very complex situation.
You make some really good points, and I want to pick up a bit of what you're saying about this search for a need for alternative livelihoods that can often drive people into searching for illegal or gaining their livelihoods through different illegal means, or also joining armed groups just in order to put food on the table, in order to keep their family safe. So we know that state actors can play a key role in exacerbating climate security risks. And as you've mentioned, rent-seeking behavior and the corruption of state authorities often allows for over-exploitation of resources and also undermines trust amongst communities and different members of said communities. And even well-intentioned but poorly designed climate and security policies carry risks that can lead to this bolstered recruitment and support for armed opposition groups out of just needing to survive. And a good example of this are water wells. Often you have organizations coming to places where water scarcity is prevalent and building water wells for those affected communities. And what is probably a well-intentioned measure could end up inadvertently contributing to a conflict between communities because a neighboring community might perceive that it's unfair for one community to receive this kind of support when theirs didn't, and considering there are often pre-existing grievances between neighboring communities in regions plagued by resource scarcity, this is unfortunately not so uncommon. And it could also be a simple matter of other communities invading or attacking this community in order to also get access to basic necessities, in this case, water, which they may not have. So this is the kind of well-intentioned policy or measure that can actually backfire when we do things without prior consultation process within local communities and actually makes people more vulnerable.
Exactly. Vulnerable to, in many cases, also recruitment to armed groups. This happens quite a lot in certain contexts in the Middle East, Western Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. And I'd like to make an important point here, since we started talking about the recruitment to armed groups, on the gender dimension, since you set the tone for justice. So let's go with it.
But it's
also a very important one, because this is a particular case in which we're not just talking about how it affects women and girls, but also how it plays out with men and boys specifically. Because for men and boys, you have this context of lack of economic prospects. So all the related threats to their identities as breadwinners and household heads coming with the food production means not being available anymore, livelihoods not being available anymore. So this increases their vulnerability to being recruited by non-state armed groups, so like terrorist organizations or also organized crime. Because in most societies in the world, men are still often seen as providers carrying responsibility to sustain their families financially and whatnot. So you have this degraded environment then limiting their livelihood options, their earning options. Income possibility offered by these armed groups, they become more attractive. They're oftentimes much better than anything they can have as a struggling farmer. And then you have a further element. We talk about that in one of our studies. The recruitment into such armed groups, they can also play into other traditionally male gender dynamics, like the possibility of achieving social status, because you can maybe rise in paramilitary ranks, you can exercise aggression and violence, and just basically have some kind of status. Because for men and boys, this will inevitably be more attractive than fighting for survival in an, for example, increasingly dry maize field where you can't make ends meet. And it's needless to say what this means for women and girls, because all of this translates into more violence in these regions where recruitment to armed groups is growing. Because women and girls, they have their own roles as well, as we know. In certain areas of Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, we have this traditional role of collecting water. This is a very typical female task. And if we think of these contexts, obviously highly impacted by climate change, then we must think their paths for collecting water is growing. It's becoming increasingly longer with time. So they're always having to walk much more in order to collect water. And of course, besides the physical burden that this represents, it also increases the chances of these women and girls suffering gender-based and sexual violence in these paths. And they do every day. So it's a very grim picture there when we look at these dynamics. Water becoming more scarce, and having to walk more violent actors on the way. And this is just, yes, difficult to imagine and difficult to talk about.
Yeah, and really exacerbating a lot of these challenges that marginalized groups are already facing in so many of these contexts. But I'm really glad that we can weave this theme of justice throughout the podcast. That's nice when we can have these conversations between the two of us.
And also for our followers to know, this was completely spontaneous. We did not plan it.
It's true. Sometimes it's just those kinds of months where, and I feel, actually, I think this is the first conversation we've had between the two of us since I joined the podcast. So I'm very happy that we could so easily come to agreement upon a topic like maladaptation.
Yes, it really is our first time.
Yeah. So,
as a duo.
Yes, exactly. So then to pick up some of the examples we've had, a lot of them have been in countries and in regions with histories of conflict and how maladaptation can make these vulnerabilities worse. But I also want to look at another example from our work in the Pacific, which since a region that does not have the same history as conflict as a lot of other of these very vulnerable regions that we look at. And one of our suggested practices that we've looked at in our regional climate security assessment guide that some of our colleagues, shout out Lucas and Spencer, let's see if they listen to the podcast to know
let's
that they got a shout
password.
Out.
They have yes. to say the password.
The password is Pacific. Please message us on Zoom. But they've been putting together this assessment guide, and one of their suggested practices is actually avoid maladaptation and mitigation through climate, conflict, and culturally sensitive approaches. So looking a little bit at the solutions side of things and how we can mitigate some of these vulnerabilities, some of these threats. And you already mentioned the need to pay attention to this gender dimension and that it's a part of ensuring responses are sensitive to their context in order to not worsen conditions for these marginalized groups. So really quick on these context-specific approaches, just a note to always be careful when taking into consideration always these cultural, historical, political, social, and environmental aspects in these regions when looking at climate and security policies.
Totally. And consulting with them, not talking to them before implementing things.
Exactly. Working together.
The step that is often jumped, and the most important one, to avoid conflict. Now, because as outsiders, even if you're well-intentioned, like we were speaking before, you can never know what can spark a conflict. You don't know the grievances that are already there before the onset of a program and the kind of problems that you can cause when you're just meaning to do something good. You really need to consult. So good point there. And also wanted to quickly emphasize, why do we look so much into maladaptation? So the negative side of adaptation, right? Because one could argue, let's just talk about adaptation and all the ways that we can do it and the resources that we can invest. And it doesn't make sense that we put our focus and our energy and our resources on creative adapted solutions. That does make sense for a while. And not just looking at risks and impacts, but rather what we can do about them, how we can solve this. But at the same time, I feel like it's important for us to talk about it because there's a lot of work still needing to be done in terms of creating the right narratives. And I mentioned in the beginning that humans always adapt one way or another to their changing environment. And while this is true, and this is absolutely true, I feel like this gets romanticized a bit too often. It's like people, oh, but people always adapt. They've all adapted to much worse or to horrible wars and things. So we don't have to worry too much about it because they will adapt. But that's simply not true. They will adapt in some way, but at what cost? At what cost for themselves? And at what cost for society in general? It always leaves a scar. And I feel like we're jumping from era to era, from decade to decade, from century to century, carrying the wounds of things that happened before us. And we carry that throughout society. And if we don't plan, we will continue carrying. And we know about climate change and environmental change in details by now. We are at that phase of granular understanding. We know how it plays, the ways in which it's coming, how it will play out in the different areas of the world, in different regions, how it will affect the different groups. So why wouldn't we act on this? We need to really stop romanticizing the fact that humans are such great at adapting as if we don't have a problem. We do. We have a problem. We definitely do.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point, and one that I think we find ourselves saying a lot with, okay, we can always use more data, sure, like different assessments, but we do know what's happening. We have a picture, and we can't keep on waiting for more and more data in order to act. Like we've talked about a little bit in this theme of coming back to the beginning of adaptation versus mitigation. We can continue to mitigate, we can focus on reducing emissions so that way things don't get as bad. But we already know the picture that emissions historically have painted. We know what is going to happen, and we know what's at stake at this point, and we know which groups are most affected, and how, again, this plays into this notion of justice of those most affected by climate change and also subsequently inaction are those who have contributed the least. So, of course, we can come to a little bit more of what are the next steps kind of tone. So what do we actually do about this? We've had a lot of examples of adaptation gone wrong, and this shows us what happens when we don't prepare for the worst or prepare without taking these contexts into consideration. Of course, our focus should be on trying to avoid these climactic changes from happening or getting worse in the first place. But I think it would be a little naive to think that is enough. Even if we would all drop everything we're doing right now and start acting on climate change in every aspect of our lives, there are already many processes in place that will still take a toll on our food, water, and energy supplies for the foreseeable future. As unfortunate and unfair as this is, like I said, we know this is happening mostly in places where populations are most vulnerable and also the least able to adapt. So if you're a professional in the area of climate, environment, development, security, or peace, you likely have a role to play in helping to reduce these risks stemming from possible maladaptation.
Yeah, for example, if you're a researcher, you can conduct a risk analysis on these world's most fragile regions, both from the climate, environment, or the security perspectives, depends on what your focus are, because those that are acting, they really need to be based on localized data, not on just, oh, the climate is changing, but rather, how is it happening here? What are the consequences of acting in this and that area? And yeah, entry points and whatnot. If you're a policymaker, you can work on creating these socio-economic safety net plans for your vulnerable populations, right? Thinking about how risks affect your populations and what would be options to create safety nets for them to prepare for the worst case scenario. Or you're maybe a peace and development practitioner, which can do perhaps education work with affected communities. You can help leverage natural resource sharing and livelihood opportunities for building peace. So these are just a few examples. And if you'd like to get more insights on how climate risks translate into insecurity and also how maladaptation to climate change is wreaking havoc in the world's most fragile regions, you can take a look at weatheringrisk.org. The flagship project, Weathering Risk, I'm sure if you're a listener, you've heard many times about it, hopefully you did, is producing a number of risk assessments, and it's using localized climate and security data where you can get a good idea on the climate security situation in local contexts, but also on the recommendations and the kind of entry points that are available in these contexts for addressing the issues stemming from climate and environmental change. And additional measures to complement what you've mentioned about can also include using local, national, and regional experts on gender and gender-based violence, conflict prevention, and peace building, and climate analysis drawing on the respective communities of practice. So ensuring inclusion of all relevant stakeholders, like we said before, including those with disabilities, including youth and marginalized groups in different stages of policy and program design and implementation. I think it's important to note that these groups need to be involved in the decision-making processes from the very start. And even to know which groups should be involved, you have to know your context. It could be that you have some kind of traditional mechanism of peace brokerage already in place. You have this in some traditional local and indigenous communities. Oftentimes you need to have the elders of a community on the table. But you can't know this if you don't study, if you don't create consultation processes in which you will be informed. It's a big mistake. And I feel like this is something that has been dragging from a colonial period in which you believe you're bringing knowledge. But actually, if you're acting in a context that is not yours and that you're not completely familiar with, you actually have to receive knowledge first.
Maladaptation in general is a really good example, like you've mentioned, how this can be really well-intentioned, but in the end, it actually does more harm than good. Even missteps in these kinds of cases aren't neutral by default. It's not, oh, okay, what we implemented didn't work. Let's take a step back. You can actually cause real harm in these communities. So I think we've gone over quite a bit of what researchers, policymakers, a lot of individuals can do when going about their work in these contexts when they come across these kinds of topics. And before, unfortunately, we start to wrap up our conversation for today, I just want to touch a little bit on how multilateral initiatives can also address maladaptation and how some actually are. So if you have also listened to some of our last podcasts, you have probably heard about the Climate for Peace Initiative from the BCSC episode when Alina and I talked about its launch. Hafsa also spoke about it during her podcast about the evolution of climate, peace, and security at the Security Council. And
so no excuse for not knowing the Climate for Peace Initiative by now. And if you're an avid climate diplomacy listener, you should know it.
Yeah, and even Ben and Janani in the first podcast of the year. So it really has been the last 3 or 4.
Oh, so pick up the tip that there's something very relevant cooking up there.
Exactly.
Ben and Janani are our heads of program in climate diplomacy and security. If you missed their podcast opening the year of 2023, do go back and listen.
Yes. If this is your first time hearing about the initiative, then you have some nice commutes to listen to some really good content. So just as a reminder, I guess, but this initiative is spearheaded by Germany and the G7, and it addresses the gap between strong political rhetoric and action in the context of climate security. And it identifies learnings from shared experiences, good practices that can be scaled up, and also, of course, what should not be replicated in order to ensure that climate security programming and assessments actually meets the criteria for efficacy. And out of this initiative, there's also a 7-point agenda for action. And adaptation strategy is certainly a part of this. So one of the points, mobilizing climate and biodiversity finance for peace, calls for scaling up finance for adaptation in line with the Glasgow call to at least double the collective provision of adaptation finance from 2019 levels by 2025. So only 2 years from now. And the third point that I really want to hit on is climate security risk-informed resilience and adaptation. So this is about
another word there, needing
resilience. Yeah, resilience. Yes. I can't believe we must have said it at some point at the podcast without even realizing
it. We dodged the bullet almost until the end.
So close. We almost made it. So improving resilience and adaptation in the face of climactic and environmental change, as well as the wider security, economic, humanitarian, environmental, and societal challenges it creates globally by bringing climate security and environmental risk assessments, climate change adaptation, disaster risk reduction, and nature-based solutions into the heart of our operations, in addition to mitigation efforts, and also utilizing data-driven science-based and comprehensive multi-sectoral approaches and analytical insights. So this is a big crux of the initiative.
Everything was in that last paragraph, a little bit of everything. Yeah.
So this is basically the summary of the episode as well, because it's also all of the things that we've touched on with data-driven approaches and making sure we actually move from talking about things rhetoric again.
I think this really is the summary. Inadvertently, we already started summarizing.
Amazing. This kind of multilateral approach inherently is encompassing kind of the crux of what we've talked about, and really like this need to act. So the initiative pools resources and also take stock of the needs of different countries to identify what these are and meet these gaps in financing, in knowledge, other different aspects. So this also, we're really coming full circle here, but this ties in with all of our earlier points on climate justice and how we need to bridge the financing gap in order to make sure that countries most impacted with the least amount of resources to adapt can actually create the programming that they need in order to ensure that they can adapt to some of these changes that we already know will happen in the coming years, even if we really take action on mitigation at this moment. So I think when I look at these topics, adaptation, maladaptation, mitigation, it's a lot of words. And sometimes we paint quite a bleak picture at different points in the podcast. But I think it creates a big sense of hope to look at some of these new multilateral initiatives that are really taking the context into account and making sure that climate justice and some of these components are at the heart of their efforts. And again, they're not, like we've mentioned many times, doing things without speaking to people in these countries who work here, who work in those places on a daily basis, who know what communities need, and making sure that they're actually meeting those needs and having a positive effect and a positive change.
Preach.
Yeah.
And you say we paint a bleak picture. Yeah, we are kind of the scarecrows now because we're always talking about risks. But that's our work. We do risk analysis. Someone has to take the bullet. And we are on this more kind of relaying the negative part of things in order for the positive change to be achieved. So it's a bit of a hard work sometimes. It has a lot of negativity, but we do look at the goal, right? The goal of action being moved forward. And I find it interesting that we say we have to act now, we have to act now. And probably inside our heads, we have this picture of the theory and the practice and nothing in between. But actually, all these points that you were relaying right now, they are action. They are needed for action. You can't jump to action, like start, I don't know, planting trees or going to communities and doing things without going through this step. So this is a step towards action. Then it's a concrete one. It may not sound, but it's good to emphasize here how much effort and resources are put from the side of the parties who are signing these agreements and these initiatives, how much they're investing, and they have to really believe in change and that this will make a difference. So I will take it as a positive thing. I do see this as being action.
Yeah, me too. I do will leave this conversation today, and I hope our listeners do as well, with a little bit of hope. Like, outlining the stakes and the different risks is important, but I also think we've really outlined maybe different opportunities, but really outlining current actions that are actually bridging this gap from we're talking about it, to actually walking the talk. Yes. And yeah.
And may all of our examples on maladaptation just feed into, okay, so we really have to support people to adapt. Let's just do it. Let's support. Let's not leave people to their faiths. Let us create these safety nets. That is the whole point on talking about maladaptation. And I hope it got through.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks to everyone for joining us today with a little bit of a special episode and a conversation between the two of us, which I personally really enjoyed.
Me too. Do you see that normally in other podcasts, probably it's the host talking, and when they have a special episode, they have a guest. But for us, it's the opposite.
Exactly.
The special episode is just the little host.
The treat for us. I mean, it's a pleasure welcoming all of our different guests, but I also quite enjoy just being able to talk to you and bring in different knowledge from our projects and the different areas of the work that we're involved with as well.
I like you too, Alex, very much.
Very glad to hear that.
You didn't know beforehand. They found out.
No, right, I've been waiting for 9 months to get a verdict.
So that was it. This was our episode. Thank you very much. This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. As always, do follow our latest updates on Twitter under Climate Diplo, and now also on LinkedIn. By the way, we are also on LinkedIn, also under Climate Diplo. Look for us there, either just Climate Diplo, or you can type Climate Diplomacy and Security. I'm pretty sure we are the only ones. And that's it. Hope to see you there. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.